welcome to the Sprocket Podcast, where we simplify the good life. My name is Brock Dittus.
And I am Adele Dittus. We are broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations. Oh, hi. By the way, you're not Aaron.
No, I'm not Aaron.
We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
Covering day-to-day life, food, alcohol, bicycles, and alternative transportation, arts and culture, communication, and the internet.
Yeah, especially alcohol. We're in the room with Aileen Crotty of Filmed by Bike and many other things. Hello, Aileen.
Hi, you guys. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. And we are also joined by a bottle of Four Roses bourbon.
Yeah, it's tasty. I'm enjoying it. I've never had it before.
It's Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, which, as I understand, is the only thing allowed to be called bourbon. Is that right? It has to be from Kentucky.
You know, I always heard that in the past.
That's what they say.
Nowadays, I'm hearing conflicting info on that. You need to look it up.
It's from Lawrenceburg, Kentucky, anyways. FourRosesBourbon.com. Oh, and there's a legend. I didn't even read this yet. There's a legend of the Four Roses.
Ooh.
I'm just going to go for it. Paul Jones Jr., the founder of Four Roses Bourbon, became smitten by a beautiful Southern belle. He sent a proposal to her, and she replied that if her answer were yes, she would wear a corsage of roses on her gown to the upcoming grand ball. When she showed up on the night of the ball in her beautiful gown, she wore a corsage of four red roses. So he later named his bourbon Four Roses as a symbol of his devout passion for the lovely belle.
Hot.
And that's apparently, yeah.
Was the fourth rose named D'Artagnan?
That's a good question. See, I know that's a literary reference or something, but I can't pull it out right now.
Oh.
What was D'Artagnan?
Alexander Dumas.
Ah, there we go.
Three Musketeers.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Right. Or there could be
but
five
it was
Musketeers.
Really the four Musketeers.
Nobody knows. We just saw the movie, the newest Simon Pegg film.
The World's End.
The World's End, which has a reference to Dumas at the beginning of the film. So, well done. Astute.
Oh, thank you. I'm here for the free booze.
It's tying our life experience together. Aaron is not here. He actually learned that one of his aging relatives is kind of doing poorly health-wise, and so he decided to go out and visit while he can. So he is out this week, and so we'll see him back. But Aaron, we love you and miss you, and travel safe. So we had you and Aileen to talk about several things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll list those off now, and then we can jump in. And I'll, as I said, I think I'll let you figure out how interesting you think they are and how much time you want to give to them. And if I think they're more interesting than you think they are, then I'll ask you more questions.
Okay, sounds great.
Is that all right?
It's a deal. It's a deal.
All right. So there was, first off, Bike Scout, which was an organized ride that you put together back on Labor Day.
Mm-hmm.
And then you went to Cycle Oregon,
mm-hmm.
which happened, what, like a week after, something like that?
A couple weeks after.
Okay. Yeah. And then Interbike.
Yep.
Which I feel like we need like effects process Interbike or something like that. The biggest trade show for bicycling in the world.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yep.
So all those things you participated in the month of September. You had the most bikey September ever.
Yeah, you know how sometimes college kids, they get to college and they go wild and they go to parties every weekend and do keg stands and they are hungover every weekend. And well, I feel like I kind of had that from a bike perspective because I had within a month Mountain Bike Oregon, Bike Scout, Cycle Oregon, and Interbike. It was like my way of partying bike style. It was all the events I've always wanted to go to, plus one that my friends and I invented. And I don't know. I couldn't ask for a better month-long experience. All of that was super fun. I got a lot out of all of it. I met some really interesting people. And it was kind of my chance to finally do some of the events that I've always wanted to do, most notably Cycle Oregon and Interbike. I had never done before and always wanted to do those.
Right, right. And then I assume you had your own bicycling, like your personal bicycling adventures mixed in with those.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
They were all kind of woven into this big tapestry of September.
Yep.
So congratulations.
Thanks.
You have done what
whirlwind.
Many try and few succeed at.
Yeah.
You want to start with Bike Scout? Because that was
sure.
the first one.
Yeah, so Bike Scout... Bike Scout was a friend of mine, two friends of mine and I went on a scavenger hunt this summer during Pedalpalooza.
And those are fun.
Yes.
So who did the Pedalpalooza scavenger hunt? Because that's the big multi-ride festival thing that happens in Portland in June.
I can't remember the woman's name. Oh, she's really sweet too.
No worries.
Terrible. Anyway, it was a benefit for an organization, the Bike Walk Vote group. And
oh,
so
right.
they were raising funds and awareness for what they were doing. And It was a really great scavenger hunt, but I was there with two of my friends who like to play board games with me. Like, we love board games. We love strategy and this, that, and the other thing. So, of course, as we're enjoying this ride and having a great time and we're highly competitive together, we love to win at these kinds of things because this is where we feel like we excel. Like, we couldn't bike race and there are some things we just couldn't do, but we get us out there in a game and we're going to work really hard, but have a good time. So all along the way, we kept thinking, wouldn't it be cool if we could do this right now, or if this were a feature of the event? So at the end of it, Matt turned to me and said, we need to put on a scavenger hunt.
Yeah. Matt Piccio?
No, Matt Stefanik. Yeah. Matt Stefanik. And we thought, oh, let's do it next summer. Yeah. Let's do it during Pedalpalooza if this one isn't happening. And then at the end of Pedalpalooza, Matt looked at me and he said, you know what? We need to do this before next summer. This needs to be a way to carry on the energy and excitement of Pedalpalooza as a way to do more during the year. Let's be those people who do things outside of Pedalpalooza, who make bike fun happen mm-hmm. outside of Pedalpalooza. And I was like, wow, that's a great idea, but I don't know if I want to take the time to do it. But we decided to do it. And our goal was to make it easy and fun for everybody involved, to focus on where our skills were, make sure everybody brought something fun to the table, nobody had to work too hard. And in the end, we decided to go on another scavenger hunt for a little market research to see what bike scavenger hunts are all about. So we went on the one for Pix Patisserie for their annual Bastille Day.
They did a bike scavenger hunt?
Yeah, apparently they do it every year. And I had never heard of it. But the grand prize was $100 or $150 gift certificate to Pix.
Really?
And I was like, oh, that could be really fun.
That's
either you could buy some really fancy booze, because they have that there, like fancy sparkly, you know, bubbly drinks, or their delicious desserts all night long.
I'm going to say that's a really big cake.
Yeah.
$100 worth, or maybe, like you said, just as many fizzy drinks as you can get.
Yeah,
well, it's not a bad idea.
And we did not win. We tried super hard.
Okay,
we thought we did really well. It turned out the team that won by a landslide, so it was a little suspect. But anyway, I won't go.
Was it by an actual landslide, like out on Highway 30 or something?
No. But we got more ideas, and on that one, Matt and I were with our friend Raina, and we told Raina, you know, we're going to go on the scavenger hunt, and we're going to be scrutinizing it because we're thinking of starting our own. So don't be surprised if we can't stop analyzing this event while we're participating in it.
Right.
By the end of the event, she turned to us and said, can I help you guys organize your scavenger hunt? Because I have lots of ideas. We're like, you're the perfect person to join. So the three of us decided to put together this event that would have not really be just about the competitive nature. It wouldn't be about who's fastest. It wouldn't be about who had the most knowledge of the city to answer the questions or find the objects or accomplish the challenges along the way. But it would really be about the team that worked best together to enjoy the event and have fun. So costumery was a big part. Team spirit and costumery, there were points related to that, as well as strategy. So looking at it in terms of, do I go for these challenge cards which have bonus points, or do I leave those behind and just try and tackle the list and really get the list done and get those points, and or some strategy in between?
Yeah.
And the
so you had things to scavenge, you had items to find.
Yep.
And then you also had things to do, like tasks to complete?
Yeah.
Okay.
One of my favorite was there was a challenge card. So you could pull from this pile and select challenge cards without knowing what they were. And they were high value points. And if you didn't complete the challenge, you were docked those points. So it was a little bit of a risk.
Okay.
And the challenges were sometimes locations you had to reach or things you had to accomplish. But one of them was that your entire team had to go into a resale store and somebody on your team had to try on an entirely new outfit and you had to take a picture and document it. So, and then another was you had to go into any sort of a shop and everybody on your team had to put on hats, and take a team photo trying on hats at whatever type of store you chose to go into to try on hats.
And both of those things are easy to do in Portland. There are many places to find unique and new outfits.
Yeah.
Entire outfits, as a matter of fact. And yeah, do you have a favorite vintage shop?
Oh, you know,
maybe that's an unfair question. There are so many.
Well, no, I used to love the one that was where the Hollywood Farmers Market is. It's now
Hollywood Farmers Market
for less now.
Mm, okay, and it got, so that's a downgrade.
No,
then.
Like it's a grocery outlet,
and now it's a grocery outlet. And it was
that used to be a Value Village. Yeah,
that was a Value Village,
but it was a really great Value Village. Like there are shitty Value Villages, and then there's that one had like all the T-shirts sorted by color.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah. was great. Well, okay, so sometimes I think, oh, I don't want to say what my favorite is because I don't want everyone to start going there. But actually, my favorite is one I so rarely get to that I don't mind sharing, and that is that I love the Goodwill on Woodstock.
Oh, yeah.
Like 48th or whatever that is.
52nd?
50 like, 52nd.
Around the corner from the Lutz Tavern, which is one of my favorites. And let's see.
It's a little off the beaten track.
It is.
Yeah.
It's basically Reed students and then people from the neighborhood.
Great and, dishes.
Yeah, gold mine.
Yeah.
Really good. It's small and simple, but I find some... I have friends that live around there and... sometimes we just wander over to the Goodwill if we're not, you know, doing other things. And it's really, there's some really fun treasures to be found at that one.
That was our Goodwill when we lived in Lentz.
Right.
Mm. I found some awesome jewelry there.
And two things. Number one, that one used to be a food liquidation place. Like they used to be able to buy discount food there and then it turned into a Goodwill as opposed to the Value Village, which left and turned into a food outlet. Number two, vintage shops and thrift stores are far better when they're kind of away from the urban center. So
absolutely.
So that one is a little bit better. The one in Newport is where I found like the first Led Zeppelin album and that pan that we still have today that we use in the kitchen and a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, there's not enough hipsters out in Newport.
Right. It hasn't been combed over. So anyways, that was a bit of a tangent. I'm sorry.
That's okay. So exploring the city and finding these kind of places.
Yeah.
That was all part of Bike Scout.
Right.
The thing that really struck us was that we created a game and there were some rules and there were opportunities for strategy and there were different approaches in order to win. There wasn't one clear path to winning. And our participants, not only did they come out in droves, they understood the game and they played the game.
Like those are very important things.
Yeah, they liked our game. That was really, really exciting to us as the organizers. We put a lot of work into it, and we really thought it through. Both Matt and Raina did a scouting day where they rode the course as if they were participants and tried different routes and thought, you know, okay, if we're going to tackle this list, which way would we choose to go, and how long will it take? Is it reasonable? Have we allotted enough time? And so we really enjoyed that people understood it and played it and played it hard and played it seriously. The winning team, okay, so I should say the largest losing team did one key thing wrong, and that was that every team member needed to be in the photo other than the person taking the picture. And it was very clear in our rules. It was written in a couple places, and we mentioned it.
Okay.
So the very, very losing team did not do that. So they didn't realize it. They came to the end, they got scored, and they lost a ton of points because of it.
It's one of those fine print situations.
Yeah, and it was there. I mean, it was pretty clear, but then the winning team did the exact same thing.
Really?
But they realized it partway through, and they hauled ass to redo everything.
Okay.
And they got to the finish line, and they had the most points. Plus, they got the most challenge points. Plus, they got best group costume and best individual costume.
Wow.
That's incredible.
So it's all about the costumes.
Yeah, the costumes went a long way. And we tried to not reward them for both costume prizes because we weren't trying to favor them, but it was like...
What were the costumes?
So they were called the Naughty Nauticals.
Uh-huh.
Naughty with a K.
And
they all had each made their own individual knot that they had learned to tie, and it was their own signature personal knot that they wore on, like as a brooch. And they all took on a different version of what Naughty was. So one woman carried around a book of knots. Another woman was kind of naughty and very sexual. And they all really got into character, and their outfits were just outstanding. They really put a lot of thought into it. And we told the crowd afterwards, you know, you might be bummed that they won both categories for costumery, but now you know what you're up against. So next year we want you to bring it.
They did such a damn fine job.
Did you give any sort of like parameters for the costumes, or was it whatever people could just come up with?
Whatever they could come up with, though we were very clear from the get-go. Costumery is important. Team spirit's important. So, you know, really put a lot of thought into what you're wearing. And we sold out within the first, or filled up, no cost involved, but we filled up within the first 2 weeks of launching the event. Which was very exciting. We capped the event at around 90 participants, and that allowed us to have a really distinct audience that we were able to talk to leading up to the event. So we were able to send them messages along the way, and we wanted it to still be a fun event where there were some surprises and we weren't giving away too much. But it allowed us to help explain the rules in advance and push things like costumes.
Right.
We love costumes. So we wanted to see people there in costume. We had costumes on. We were the scout leaders.
The hat that goes along with scouting, that sort of thing?
We didn't. We wished we had. We couldn't find a good hat.
Has an amazing hat that we got to borrow a while back.
Everyone knows who he is.
That's right. Yeah.
And along those lines, we wanted to be clear with people that while this was a scouting related event and we're very much pro scouting the city and looking for things, that we aren't pleased with what's going on in the Boy Scouts, but we are pleased and excited about 55th Cascadia, which is the local scouting troop here in Portland that Ethan Jewett is involved in.
Right.
And they're all ages and all genders, and they're doing some exciting things to teach kids a lot of really valuable skills, which I felt I learned as a Girl Scout. But the politics behind what's going on with the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts, if they were to actually say anything, probably are pretty in line with the Boy Scouts, unfortunately. So we wanted to create something that, you know, we don't have a cause that we support, but we do like to, through our work with Bike Scout over the time, we want to be raising more awareness for 55th Cascadia because what they're doing is pretty awesome.
Yeah, for sure. We actually need to have some folks in from that. I know that's why Ethan has the hat.
You've interviewed core members.
Yes. Not all at the same time. Yeah.
Right,
and yeah.
Right.
So at some point, we'll...
I was thinking of the wrong Ethan, actually.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
It was another Ethan with another hat.
Oh, gotcha. There are so many Ethans with
so many
hats. Yeah. It sounds like, I mean, this was a competitive event, but not necessarily, it wasn't about who gets in first.
Yeah, that was the neat thing about it. There was a prize, there was point value to getting in early. So if you got in early, you got extra points. Not many, and we're probably going to change that next year.
Sure.
There wasn't a huge incentive to get back early, though people felt that because there is this like sense like, I want to be first. And actually being first didn't get you all that many points, so it really wasn't all that valuable. But then we had these cards that were pink. We called them pink envelopes. And if you were the first person to a location, there were a few set locations on the manifest, the main list everyone had to conquer. And if you got there first, you were looking around to see if there was a pink envelope. You didn't know if you were there first, but if you were, you would see a pink envelope and you'd know, oh, our team's here first. So you take the pink envelope and what's inside is all good stuff. So there was no way to be docked anything by what's in there, but it would say things like you get a bonus 10 points, jump up in the air, take a photo, high fives, take a photo, whatever it was. And one of the things, there were some things in there that were game changers. So if you got back to the finish line, your pink envelope would say, congratulations, you get cuts. It means you get to go back in line a couple spaces and you get to take the time priority from the team that got there before you. So
Wow.
If they were getting points for being back early, now you get their points. And Wow. maybe they don't
that
get any.
Really...
And that's what upset the first team that
Yeah.
did everything wrong. They got back early and then they lost their
they
lost their points because so many game changers happened after them that they wound up getting knocked out of position.
Yeah.
And they just like, they lost, and the best part was.
They lost their morale.
They lost all
them?
Around. I knew them, and there a lot of them were longtime bike community people who were lingering at the start line. First of all, we thought, they're acting really confident, and they're lingering, and everybody left 10 minutes ago, and they're still here, and they're not strategizing. They're just drinking their beers. And then one of them came up to me and said, pointed at the manifest and said, real coy, next time, Aileen, you got to make this harder. And then they totally lost. And
yeah.
I was like, oh, but they had a good time doing it. And they're good. They're good people. And I wish them all the best of luck next year.
Of course.
They did try and bribe the judges. But this is one event where we accepted no judge bribing.
There we go.
But it was a game. And we wanted to play by the rules. And we wanted people to see and read the rules and play by them. Because to me, that's when a game is most fun.
Right.
What's the point of a game if not to use the rules that are... Because the rules are what make the game. Now, rules get a bad rep in this world. You know, I hate rules. I don't want someone telling me what to do.
It depends on the rules.
But if you're playing a game, that is the framework of the game.
Yeah.
So
I like the rules that make my life feel better.
Oh.
But, you know.
Okay.
No, well, like the rules about quiet hours. Except last night, I think someone was throwing like boxes of bottles around or something like that. And they were hitting the floor. And like you could hear it through the... Yeah, I would like those rules better if they worked. Like if people actually
this is a major tangent, but we've had a lot
most
more disturbances at night in this neighborhood than in Lentz, which
right.
has the bad rep. But now that we're here, there's like, we've had like fireworks going off at 3 a.m. We've had, some people throwing bottles at 11.
And Adele, you're a heavy sleeper. I have a hard time going to sleep if I know that there are shenanigans afoot. And so I end up like getting up and walking around in my bathrobe and like, where are they? Where are those damn kids? I'll catch them in the act. So yeah, that's me. I'm old. I'm older than I thought I was already.
I think that's how we're going to come full circle.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, all that to say.
Rules can be helpful.
They worked in this case.
Yep. Yep. So Bike Scout was teams of 3 to 5 people. We'll keep that again for next year. This was definitely an experimental year. We're very excited to bring it back next year. Everyone who completed successfully made it to the finish line this year received a patch, an embroidered patch. That's their scouting badge. Ooh. And they'll receive those every year. There will be an entry fee next year, and our entry fee goes to cover the cost of our badges and to pay our band. We did not pay our band this year.
Okay.
We were very, very lucky to have Jacob Miller and the Bridge City Crooners playing their old ragtimey music.
Nice.
Our finish line was at Velo Colt Bike Shop and Tavern, so to have this old-timey music in that location was just amazing. And Jacob and his crew did an amazing job. We passed the hat, and participants were extremely generous. But next year, it's a real priority of ours to pay a band very well, to have that be a part of what Bike Scout's all about, is rewarding artists for bringing their music and sharing it with us for the day. So we're excited for that. And we allowed in around 90 participants this year, and it's not going to grow a whole lot next year. We definitely loved the size and the feel of it. We started at the back lot of Hopworks Bike Bar on Williams. And so we filled it up, and that was a good size. And then being at Velo Colt at the finish line, it felt good and full. We don't want to have to, we love those locations. We'd love to stay there. And it was a very manageable crowd size where people got to talk to each other. At the finish line, different teams would sit and swap stories with each other. Like, oh my God, did you get any pink envelopes? I never saw a single pink envelope. Where were they? Oh, you had to look all around. I saw one really high on a telephone pole. And we're just sitting there listening to all this, like, this is amazing.
Yeah, so, kind of seeing it all pay off.
Yeah, and we want that kind of community feel to the event. We never want it to feel too large. And for us as the organizers, it's a very manageable size. We feel very much in control of the chaos at that point. So next year, it's going to grow a little bit, and it'll probably be in July or August again next year, and hopefully we get a great turnout again next year.
Yeah, and that's about capacity too at Velo Colt, assuming you end there again next time you do it. Like, you can't pack that many people in there, so
it's true.
So if you like competition, you've got first the competition to like register and get your slot in the game, and then the actual game. So so if you like competition, there's like tons of it here just waiting for you.
That's right.
Nice.
Yep.
Well, congratulations. Sounds like it was a smashing success.
Thanks.
I wish I could have been there, but I was amongst corn in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. So yeah, it's about as far away from Portland and vintage shops as you can get.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, congratulations.
Thanks.
So Cycle Oregon?
In mid-August, I went to Mountain Bike Oregon down in Oak Ridge, Oregon. I won't get into all the details of that, though. It is an awesome event if you like mountain biking. I was down there to work it, and I found out that a friend of mine, while I was there, he was selling smoothies at Mountain Bike Oregon, and I found out that he was going to be selling smoothies at Cycle Oregon for the first time ever. Cycle Oregon needed a new smoothie vendor, and he was asked to come do that. Now, he doesn't have a smoothie outlet in Portland. He doesn't run a food cart.
Does he have a smoothie license?
He just practices in his kitchen.
He's a rogue smoothie maker.
His wife is Betsy Platt. She's an amazing acupuncturist, and she's been working with Cycle Oregon for many years. So when she heard from Cycle Oregon, which is a lot, the behind-the-scenes folks involved are a lot like a family, and they said to her that they were looking for someone, and she said, well, why don't you ask my husband, Mike? I mean, he makes me a smoothie every day.
And they're good smoothies.
So when I heard he was doing it and he needed some help, I immediately jumped on it. I said, I'll go help you. I love working events. I love smoothies. And I've always wanted to go to Cycle Oregon.
There we go.
So I had about 2 weeks to prepare for Cycle Oregon.
And speaking of competition, getting into Cycle Oregon is a really highly competitive process, isn't it? Like, the reason you can't get in is, number one, because it's really expensive. And if you don't have, like, is it $3,000 extra sitting around or something?
That's interesting you bring that up, because it is around, I believe it's under $1,000. It's around $900.
Oh, okay.
For 8 days, all meals included, entertainment at night, and hot showers.
That's
I think
not
it's
bad.
A great deal. A lot of people talk crud on it.
Yeah.
But if you look at hotel prices and meals for traveling, I think it's a great price. But for a lot of people, they want to be on their own schedule when they're bike touring, which totally makes sense. I mean, that's all I had ever done in the past.
And maybe $900. The last time I checked into Cycle Oregon stuff was like 4 years ago, I think, when I last thought, oh, maybe that'd be a possibility.
Well, it depends, too, what you want to do, because $900 could stretch a long way for a bike tour.
Yeah. And at that point
in
my life.
You could make that last, like, months.
Yeah. At that point in my life, that seemed like a much larger chunk of money. Yeah. So,
yes, exactly. Yeah. I used to think it was totally unattainable.
And now you're rolling.
And it used to, Cycle Oregon used to sell out right away.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was such a huge, their servers would crash. And they probably still do because everyone tries to get online. They have a big to-do where they release the route. And they've been around for, I think, 26 years now. And they do a big to-do in February and they release this year's route. And it's very exciting. And each route, each year has a theme. And this year's theme was the Wild West of Eastern Oregon.
Yeah.
And saddle up. That was this year's little, little tagline.
Right.
I never wanted to go as a participant alone. I liked the idea of going and having a purpose. So being a vendor and being more involved in the behind the scenes totally suited my interests. Plus, I had friends that were vendors as well. Two of my friends worked for Nasa Familia Coffee at the event. So we had sort of vendor camp and vendors knew each other. And there aren't a lot of vendors there. And so that made the event extremely fun. But I only had about 2 weeks to prepare for it. And the riding was an average of around 70 miles a day.
Okay. And you rode each day then?
I rode about half the time because when I finished riding, then I would jump into the smoothie booth sometimes without changing out of my bike clothes, which
there we
is
go.
A bad idea. That day it was really uncomfortable at the
now
end of the
with
day.
Extra protein.
But I hadn't ridden 70 miles straight in probably about 10 years. And granted, in the past, I'd always ridden with gear. And I'd ridden shorter distances. But anyway, I got a little intimidated thinking, oh, man, I have to make sure I'm not the slowest rider because I need to get to the smoothie booth at the end of the day and work. So I felt like I needed to train, which I've written lots of articles on how to train for century rides and whatnot as part of my job. But I had never done any training. Like, I just jump out and ride my bike with my friends and go on a little bike tour or whatever. So then I kind of took it on as my personal kind of funny project that I was going to train. And I wound up rediscovering Portland in a lot of ways.
Uh-huh.
You know, I rode around with a couple friends and I went out, you know, five times or so, not a ton, but I was just trying to clock some miles. And I went out to the Springwater and rode Marine Drive and did that big loop. And that was lovely. And I rode Northwest Salzman, which is gravel.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And like, I hate
our
gravel, but it was awesome.
That's Adele's favorite.
Yeah, maybe not our.
The jury's still
you
out
into
for me.
throwing you into the package. I am obsessed with Salzman.
It was cool. And I hate gravel, but I just got into my head and focused and I was alone and I just like went for it. It was cool. And it was quiet. I was there on a weekday. Nobody was there.
Yeah, no cars. Yeah, it's blocked to traffic. It's fantastic.
So you found yourself going to places that you wouldn't normally go just because you were looking for the extra mileage.
Yeah, I was just looking for the extra mileage and I was wanting to use that as an opportunity to explore areas. And so then when I got to Cycle Oregon, I felt great because I had done a bunch of riding and I ride a steel frame and I got offered lighter weight bikes for Cycle Oregon. And in the end, I said no because I wanted to be on a bike that I knew well and was comfortable with. And I'm very glad I did that because I was then part of sort of the steel frame crew, which is, you know, there's a small posse of people out there riding steel frames.
The small but robust contingent.
Yeah.
Kind of give you a nod. And then on days when obviously I'm not the head of the lead of the pack, but I shouldn't say obviously. You guys may, in listener land, may not know that, but I'm not necessarily at the front of the pack when I'm riding because I'm not that strong of a rider. But wherever I was, I felt great because I thought, well, those guys are all on these lightweight bikes and here I am riding a steel frame with my rack on the back.
Right.
And I felt great. And I think that's a real part of Cycle Oregon for people is that at the end of the day, you've conquered some miles and you're going to do it again the next day in most cases, but you've conquered some miles. So you feel healthy, of course, but also sort of victorious. Like, hey, I made it through that day. And then you're sitting around with 2,500 of your closest biking friends at the end of the day and swapping stories. And I don't know, it's just everybody's super supportive. It doesn't matter if you're a strong rider or you're a new rider. Everybody's there to help each other out. I think partially because with Cycle Oregon, you're camping along the way. So there is no hotel option. It's not like, well, some people hotel, some people camp. Mm. Everybody camps. Okay, I will say there are some RVs, but I don't even want to talk about
that. That's kind of like a hotel.
That's a whole other world. I don't even want to get into that.
Some of them are as big as hotels.
But it is limited, so there aren't a lot of RVs. So really, mostly everyone's camping. So there is this sense that we're all in it together because we have such limited resources and we're sleeping on the ground. And that really brings people together. So the community of Cycle Oregon is amazing. So the thing is, I've been an event coordinator for the last 13 years, and I was very excited to go to Cycle Oregon as an event coordinator and see how they run their systems and details because I'm into that. I kind of nerd out. We call it being an event nerd.
You're all about logistics and how you make things happen and how, like, you know, people show up for their shifts on time, that sort of thing.
Line flow. Like, if you can, like, talk about line flow for an hour, you are an event nerd, and I could talk about line flow for an hour.
Wow. I kind of wish I knew what it was, but then we need a separate podcast.
I kind of
want to
hear you talk about line flow for an hour, but I'll have
What's the nutshell example of line flow?
How a queue of people flows.
Can we call it a queue?
Yeah, let's call it a queue.
I was just going to ask you that.
But I knew I would like the event because I'd always heard how well organized it was and whatnot, but I had no idea that I would fall deeply, deeply in love with Cycle Oregon. I mean, I loved it. I can't wait to go back next year. And, you know, it helped that I was hanging out with friends and new friends I was making through my friends, and I was hanging out with a very like-minded community of people that were vendors and friends of vendors. If I had just been a regular rider, maybe I wouldn't have had quite the same experience, but I was able to tap into a more like-minded group of people pretty much immediately. And that made a huge difference mm-hmm. for me. I felt like we had great conversations in the evenings and we had lots of fun together and whatnot. Yeah. So,
Oregon is the most beautiful state.
Yes, it is.
In the lower 48.
It's the best damn state in the union.
That's why I moved all the way out here.
Yeah. No, I was just going to ask, you talk about finding like-minded people. Would you say that you were in any way the minority of people that were there? Like, did you think that you were different than the other participants or the other people working? Or is it kind of like everybody has to find their tribe of, like, the kind of person you are and what you would get into?
Yeah, everybody finds their tribe. But, you know, there was a friend of mine who's been many, many years, said he felt like there was sort of a younger contingency. Their average age on Cycle Oregon, I believe, is 52.
Okay.
Or median age. I don't know which it is.
So to.
It is not, you know, it isn't, I'm 38 and I don't mind hanging out with people of any age, don't get me wrong.
Oh, sure.
But it was this year felt like there was a significant number of people who were younger, and it's what Cycle Oregon needs over time to remain viable, because eventually some people are not going to be able to continue riding 70 miles a day. So
Right. That
was nice to see. And the overall crowd was just so friendly and nice. So it's just a very welcoming event that way.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
good. Well, and I always think of Cycle Oregon as like a bunch of people wearing Lycra and racing like Lance, which I'm mm-hmm. sure there's some of that, but like, I think I've let that put me off of the concept, mm-hmm. like to the point where I would be like, oh, I would never do that because I don't want to hang out with those guys.
Exactly.
But that's like my own prejudices coming out, as well as probably not very accurate, I'm sure.
Well, and perhaps I should have started this whole review of Cycle Oregon by saying that is exactly what I thought of for all the 13 years I've known about it.
Okay.
I always thought that about it. And but I just went into it doing my own thing. I didn't wear a jersey ever, even though I have jerseys, they're not for me. And I was fine. I wore just what I like to wear when I ride, and people tried to talk me into, oh, you should wear a jersey because blah, blah, blah. I'm like, but I never wear one here, so why should I wear one there? And mm-hmm. there were days where people made comments about, you know, cold days. I warm up. I'm a commuter. I know how it works. And so there was a very cold morning, and I just wore what I wore, and I didn't wear much because I knew I'd warm up, and I didn't want to have gear with me, even though there are gear drops. I just didn't want to have to deal with that. So I set out a little bit cold, but I warmed up quickly, and one woman rode by me and said one word, brr.
Oh, no.
It was weird. It wasn't It wasn't friendly and supportive like Cycle Oregon.
Did you spend the rest of your day like imagining what your retort would have been?
Like I did for a little while. And then I was like, okay. I couldn't think of anything good. And then then after quickly after that, we turned off onto this road that said, No hunting, no shooting, no trespassing, but we all kept going, and then we were in the woods. So any ideas of like things I didn't like about what people had said, I just immediately dissipated, because we were on paved Forest Service roads for most of the next of the 50 some, maybe 60, 50 miles of paved Forest Service roads through the woods. It was incredible riding. It's this hidden gem of a road. I can't remember what number it is out in Eastern Oregon, but we were at that point, we were going from Seneca to John Day, taking a really circuitous route because Seneca and John Day are rather close.
They're right next to each other, basically.
Yeah, but we made it into routes. It was like a 60 mile day for us or something like that. So they found this roundabout way to get there, which included a 4 mile climb, which was only about 4% grade, so not super steep. That's a kind of where you don't even need all your gears to get there if you have a lot of gears. So that was a nice climb, and we were all kind of looking at each other. There were, you know, usually when you ride, there's one row of people riding. There's usually two people next to each other, but on that there were four.
Nice. It
was kind of like the four lanes depending on how fast you were going. And No one was walking for the most part. I'd say almost everyone was riding it, and it was intense and it was super hot. But we all did it. You know, that's part of Psych Oregon, is like, okay, we all did this and that wasn't that great. And people get to the top and talk about it, and then you fly down for miles and miles and miles.
Yeah, pain brings people together.
It does. It does.
And the wide open landscape of Eastern Oregon, which I had never been to and had always wanted to go to, was just amazing and breathtaking.
So this is your first time in the high desert, like anywhere?
I had been out a little bit I've been to high desert in terms of like Sisters.
And okay.
I had been to Bend, you know, but I hadn't really been to Eastern Oregon.
Right.
So
right.
I'd been to Pendleton, but that's like its own little place up there. And I hadn't really explored around the area.
Yeah.
But this was, we got to spend time in a tiny town called Crane.
Crane
is really neat. They
like
have
a bird?
Yeah, like the bird crane.
Or like a construction implement.
I'd like to think of it as the
bird. Yeah.
They have a public boarding school there. It's a public.
Oh. Is this the only one in Oregon, right?
Yep.
But
yep.
It's public because the kids come from such a wide range of places. Like the population is so sparse that all these kids end up living in a boarding school, just because like to make a school's worth of kids, you have to go for like hundreds of miles in each direction.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And you are welcome to go to that school if you live outside the region. So there are some families who choose to send their kids way out there.
Oh, really?
Because maybe they don't like where they are and they just want a different schooling experience for their kids. I think Reverend Phil may have gone to that school.
Really?
He once told me he went to a boarding school in Oregon, so it must have been that one.
Well, yeah. Unless it was like a parochial or something. I don't know.
But I remember him saying it was public. So, yeah.
Well, that narrows it down.
Yeah, it must have been Crane. So in Crane, you know, it's super cute. Every town we go through, the local community helps out. There's always a community booth where you get to learn about the community history, and they have photos and people there to share their community history. And a lot of the Psycho Oregon participants go and talk to the community booth people, which is neat to see. Hmm. People really want to know about these towns we are going through. And in Crane, you know, people volunteer from the community, and there it was just like the kids from the school helping carry bags and get things set up, and they were all so pleasant and friendly, and there was every town we went to, everyone was very excited to have us come through. And we went into, there's one place in town, in Crane, I mean, to get food. It's also the RV park, the gift store, the bar, and the market.
The
it's all
shop.
In one.
Yeah, yeah.
And we went there. They had a fundraising barbecue because their funding got cut at the school for a school librarian. So there's absolutely no funding for a school librarian. So they had a barbecue with the idea that Psycho Oregonians would come and have dinner if they wanted. Could have had dinner in camp. It's all included. But sometimes people just like to get out of camp. And
a little variety.
So the Nossa Familia coffee crew and I went out there, and it was really neat to get to talk to the locals, you know, hear about what's life like in Crane. And we found that they were all so friendly and very well spoken and just nice. And they were excited to share what, you know, their life is like with us. And it was just a very brief moment, but to me, that was a highlight of the entire 8 days of being out there.
Yeah.
So it was pretty incredible.
Well, and that's, again, the great thing about Cycle Oregon, from what I understand, is that it's a huge economic shot in the arm for a lot of the towns that it goes through, because like a lot of towns are kind of imploding financially. Like, it's really hard to make things work in today's economy, even as it's kind of swinging up in the cities. Like, rural America isn't doing all that well. So to be able to swing through there with, like, how many again?
2,500.
Okay, yeah. 2,500 bicyclists all rolling through. And more likely than not, some people are spending money and buying, you know, Snickers bars or power bars or whatever it is that they need. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, and the, you know, a lot of the credit goes to Cycle Oregon as a foundation as well, because they work hard to ensure that they can draw as many services from the local community as possible, so that they do also have a foundation program to give back to the communities, where communities can apply for grants for different things, and they'll help fund that with the money that's raised through Cycle Oregon. But beyond that, they like to just straight up dollars for services give back to the communities wherever they can. A lot, all the food is served by local community groups from the region who come and serve food, and then they raise money by doing that. So they're getting, you know, for every person volunteering, they're getting so much money for their club or their troop, or their, there was a Native American tribe that worked with us in two of the towns. So it's just neat to see that, and everyone's friendly, and it's a great way to bring a huge number of people through these communities for support. But what I also really like is that it's not just some random huge group of people. It's bikers.
Right.
It's showcasing these communities. 2,500 really friendly bikers just gave your town a bunch of money and were nice while they were here. I mean, generally, everyone is very thankful of the volunteers and very friendly towards them. So it's just a neat event that's spreading a lot of, it sounds so cheesy, but it's true. It's spreading a lot of goodwill through Portland, through Oregon, and showcasing that bikers are nice people. And it's people coming from all over the world to participate in this event too. Yeah. So that's really neat.
It's kind of like diplomacy almost. Like,
it is.
If you thought that it would be hard to go out and bicycle in rural Oregon, maybe it's less difficult in certain places because people have had good experiences with those.
Yeah, and you know, I've done a lot of bike events over the years. I've run a lot of bike events over the years, and I've seen a lot of animosity towards cyclists in certain communities on the way towards the Oregon coast, for example.
Uh-huh.
I won't name names.
It's okay. But, I think I know the town you're talking about.
But this was great. They... considering we took over the roads, and in some areas you can't just say like, oh, they're on 5th Street, I'm going to go over to 6th Street. It's like, whoa, we're on the one road that
goes
Main
Street,
here for 50 miles or whatever.
I won't ask you to confirm this, but I suspect it has something to do with the stop sign.
Well, yes, there's that too. There's that too.
But we don't have to talk about who that was.
So we found that generally drivers were very considerate and moved out of the way, and they weren't like, get out of the way, you stupid bikers, get off the road. But you know, the days I rode, people shared the road with us, we shared the road with them. I don't know, it was just it was a nice nice experience out there.
It's nice to engender goodwill every now and again.
Yes, indeed.
One of the other things I was thinking about as you were talking about connecting with the people in the community and having conversations and figuring out how life works in this small town as you're there, that's one of the great things about bicycle touring. But when you're doing it solo or duo or in a small group of people, sometimes that can be difficult to do just because, like, either like I'm off my game, for example, like I'm having a shitty day and I feel like I need calories and I don't really want to talk to anybody, or it just seems like you're not going to bump into anyone who really wants to talk to you. Whereas if you show up with this event, you're probably going to meet a bunch of people that are really excited about it. So that's kind of cool. It's almost like a jump start for that social connection.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, for anyone listening, that you know, there are ways to be involved in Cycle Oregon that don't cost the full amount. There are ways to volunteer, and that's great. But if Cycle Oregon's just not for you, but you're intrigued by this idea of Eastern Oregon, the...
Eastern Oregon? There's an eastern half?
Exactly.
Weird.
It doesn't where it doesn't rain.
Exactly.
Tell us of this magical place.
Right. Yeah. Did not rain.
Yeah. And the gold flows from the hills like liquid.
And the
you
sun
scoop it up
shines.
And put it into your pockets. Yeah.
Well, so Travel Oregon has their innovative scenic bikeways program, and they developed a route out from John Day, the Old West Scenic Bikeway, which is about 2 or 3 days of riding, depending on how much you want to tackle. And I had wanted to go out and do that ride. I thought I was going to do that this fall, and now I don't have to because I did Cycle Oregon, which is a very similar route, or it's in a lot of the same region. But
yeah, Russ and Laura from Pathless Pedal did a great write up on that like a year ago, and I guess they made a promo video about it too.
That's what got me inspired.
Yes.
I saw their video.
Seeing the images.
Sounds like
beautiful.
So much fun.
It was neat to, on my way driving to Cycle Organ, I drove straight to John Day and I saw things that I had seen in their video. I'm like, oh, that's where they had ice cream. Yeah. Oh, that's where they sat on the porch.
Yeah. There's only one place to have ice cream out
probably.
There.
Probably.
Yeah. Beautiful rocks too, like the red rocks and I mean, it probably depends on how much sun is out too,
and if you're
and
a geologist, you just go batshit crazy because it's so incredible.
Like, you're an armchair geologist
of that. That area.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. The strata are impressive. Said the armchair geologist. Well, very cool. It's cycleoregon.org. Is that?
I think so.
Okay,
yep. And so every February is when they release the open registration for the next year. They also offer a weekend ride. For me, that's not as interesting. For me, it's that full week-long, really inclusive experience that's really where there were areas where we had no cell phone coverage. You're just not on your devices. You know, I tried to be because I was doing some reporting from there, but I wasn't seeing a whole lot of activity from people, and they were just, you just couldn't necessarily get on your devices. And almost everyone I talked to about that said, and you know what? That's pretty great.
Right, right.
The
terrifying
disconnection
at first
is pretty amazing. It's cool.
And then once you're over the shakes, you feel pretty good.
Exactly.
So yeah. CycleOregon.org. You get to camp with a bunch of people. There's entertainment every night. You get fed. There are smoothies.
There are smoothies.
And if you don't like carrying your own shit around, there are people to carry it for you.
Yep.
So, yeah, good way to get into a long-distance tour if, for any reason, you've never done it and would like to.
Yep.
But you're afraid to start on your own. So, yeah, please check it out. And maybe someday I'll do it. It'd be nice.
Someday, when you're 52.
When I'm 52, yeah. I was actually thinking I should look into volunteer opportunities.
I know,
that'd be pretty
I'm thinking
fun.
That, too. That would be so cool.
Totally.
We have, like, a whole year to figure this out.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. Well, yeah. And then I guess the February thing, when everyone lines up at the gates to buy tickets.
Nothing else to do in February.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Very cool. Well, would you like another shot of the bourbon before we talk about... Okay,
sure.
Please.
That's a great idea. Thanks. This is very...
Dose yourself as you see fit.
Tasty bourbon.
Because we're about to talk about Interbike. Oh, and
you need booze for
you
it.
Might... You might need that.
Interbike isn't the same without booze.
Right. So this is it's a huge trade show. And what kind of led you to want to go to Interbike?
I had always wanted to go to Interbike. I think mostly because I understood it is a trade show. It is an industry expo. It is not for the general public.
Yeah.
The general public is not welcome there. In fact, they hinder business by being there.
Uh-huh.
It's not a good idea. And we could talk about more about that later.
Yeah.
But
this is for insiders.
Yeah, but it is... And a lot of people go to Interbike with stars in their eyes thinking they're going to have this magical experience. And then they go and they realize it's kind of a shitstorm and it's a crazy event. And if you don't know what you're doing, you just get totally lost and all you do is party. And that's maybe what some people want. But I feel like in Portland, if I want to party with bike people, there are people to party. Bike
you don't have to
party
go to Vegas
all the
for
time.
That, right?
Vegas attracts businesses from all over the world.
Yeah.
So for some people, it's probably very exciting because they don't get to hang out with bike people all the time. But we're in Portland.
Well, it's an excuse to go to Vegas, too, if you're looking for that.
Yeah.
Vegas seems like the most unbikey place.
It's not very bike-friendly.
Yeah.
No. But I had always wanted to go because I like following the trends of the bike industry. I'm very curious about... the bike industry finally recognizing that women also ride bikes and being willing to make products that are maybe more helpful for women, or just sell them things in a way that doesn't make them feel like idiots or recognizes that they have different bodies. I'm also very excited about businesses who are making apparel related to cycling that maybe stretches better in the shoulders and has some other features that are great for riding, but doesn't look like traditional race wear because I'm not out to race. I'm just out to ride my bike. And
it's not plastered with like advertising or logos or something.
Yeah.
You want to look okay when you get off the bike.
Yeah. Some pants, you know, and so I'm very excited about some of the newer trends. I'm excited to see bag makers and other product lines happening. So I try and keep my eye on a lot of that. I do reporting for orbike.com and I like to see what's out there. And I'm just fascinated by the bike industry in general. I think it's a great industry. It's a very complicated industry because it is recreation, it's sport, it's transportation, and it's hobby. And it's all of that together. And then beyond that, there are the different sport disciplines. It's not just like tennis, you play tennis. I mean, maybe there's like clay courts and grass, but what, you know, doubles and singles, like what else is there? Well, we have triathletes and mountain bikers and cyclocross and now gravel and fat bikes and beach cruise, you know, there's all these different disciplines within it.
Yeah.
So I find it fascinating. And I always thought it would be neat to go to Interbike and just be a part of that mayhem.
Just see it happen.
If you see it happen. Once. I like expos. I like working expos. I like being at expos. I'm kind of into those kinds of events.
You like the buzz, like just like all the people kind of all converging at one place. And
and the people working it, like watching people in their booth, like working it. I'm like, I've been there. I've worked it. Like, so it's fun.
Speaking of people in the booth working it, like, was how much sexism would you say there was there compared to previous years?
Okay, so the worst thing is there's this. It's like a product you can get for a conference for like expos and trade shows. It's a mannequin with big tits who has a mechanism in her chest to twirl a sign. So she doesn't even twirl it, but the sign twirls as if someone's outside of a mattress store saying sale today, sale today. And you can put that outside your booth and people had it. And
so it's not explicitly connected to, bicycling in any way,
but people used it at their booths.
It is explicitly connected to being there, I guess.
And it's a fake woman. Uh-huh. And it wasn't even like her hair was kind of tussled, and but not in like a ooh, just got out of bed way. It was just kind of a really cheap looking mannequin.
A creepy mannequin.
Just
way.
Mannequins are creepy. Like, I think they used to be cool like 100 years ago.
Well, it depends on the style of the mannequin too. Like,
that's,
I mean, there's
true.
Several styles. Some of them are so lifelike that they look creepy. Some of them are so unlifelike that they also look creepy.
And this one just looked pathetic.
Yeah.
She was all stiff and her hair was all messed up and
tussled.
But hey, check out the bazooms. Why don't you?
Yeah.
So
like a fake woman selling product was bad. And then there were a ton of the women that were there just because they had hot bodies to try and sell product. And
like, you know, they don't really care about bikes.
Maybe they do, but that they are not hired because they care about bikes.
Hot women don't care about bikes.
Yeah, they are hired not for their brains and not for their interest in bikes. They are hired solely for their bodies.
Right.
And they dressed like it too. I mean, they were made to. That was part of their job.
Right.
I'm not faulting them at all.
But
that was kind of a different sect. You know, I wasn't necessarily in that world. Interbike is so gigantic that I could.
Are they all over one corner?
Yeah, they were in a
zone.
Go
over to the sexism corner over there.
Yeah, they were in a zone that I wasn't going to. And I don't really know what zone that was. I didn't see them a lot. But they were definitely in, I think they're in the BMX zone.
Yeah,
to be honest, I think BMXers had more of that going on.
Okay, so we know who to blame then. Good times.
And there are just some companies that just have outdated marketing and thinking. And they think that that's what's going to sell their product. And as opposed to like DZR, which is a shoe company that makes shoes that clip in and look really great. They had this wood booth and they shared it with Swerve, which makes great looking clothing for riding. And they had a great looking booth and they were just hanging out in there and they didn't have a tittied lady. Like, the lady there with tits is the product designer and she's a rock star and she's really good at her job.
She's
and
there
she
because she did a good thing.
Great shoes. Yeah.
Yeah.
She's not there for her tits. She's there because those are her shoes that she made.
Yeah.
So there's different camps there at Interbike.
Right. But I just amuse myself by thinking of like Interbike having a red light district or something.
Oh,
like,
my God. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
It could.
Rough.
People would go to it. But anyway, people are there. You know,
but you're already in Vegas. You just go
just
outside the city limits and
you're
fine.
In Las Vegas.
Yeah. Yeah. Ridiculous. So you found the best parts of the convention to kind of spend your time in and places that you enjoyed.
Well, so I spent my first day just getting the lay of the land for half the day, which was really hard and fun. And then I was most interested in reporting on a variety of things that would be interesting to the OR bike readership. And I also wanted to report on this idea of new trends in products. So I did spend some time with DZR. Now, the interesting thing about DZR shoes is they're one of the first companies to make a street style shoe, a shoe that looks like a sneaker that clips into your pedal.
Right.
And, you know, clipping into your pedal is not for everyone. But once you do start to clip in, often you find that, well, when I'm going on a distance ride or, you know, anything more than 5 miles or some people it's less, they really like that and they want to keep doing that. Yeah. So to be able to do it with a little bit of flair and style is pretty awesome.
Can't stop.
Didn't Chrome have like a clip in sneaker?
Yeah. So DZR launched right at the same time as Chrome. And they DZR went to chat with Chrome.
Yeah.
Because I think they were both in San Francisco and they went to chat. And then Chrome was like, oh, hey, how are you guys doing? It's great to talk to you. Look at our new shoe. And DZR was like, what? But we're doing shoes.
But we just started our own shoe line.
Yeah, but it's okay. There's room for both of them. But it is right. that same concept. So yeah. within the sneaker sole, there's usually a steel plate or a reinforced sole of some sort that gives it some stability to allow you to clip in without just like tearing out your sole every time you unclip. DZR makes a variety of soles, so you can purchase your shoe based on how stiff you want it, and different models are stiffer than others.
Okay.
So within that, now I think these street shoes are great, and I'm excited about what they're doing. They come in women's sizes. They're kind of a unisex style. They're not very feminine. But they're unisex, and they've got some great styles that are sized down to about a 6.5 in women. So that is really amazing. A lot of what company makes a shoe that's unisex and goes from that to a tall men's size?
Right.
So it's interesting. And so I like what they're doing. But I was hoping to see that they're going to be expanding this line of really cool looking clip-in shoes that you could have a 10-mile commute and get to a meeting and still look great if you like to clip in.
Question, do they have clip-in high-heel boots yet?
No.
Okay. Any kind of heel?
They have
no
a boot.
Clip-in
they
heels?
Have a boot.
They have a clip-in boot.
Yeah, ooh. It's a cool. masculine looking, but it is a boot. And I think it's a limited edition. I've seen it on their website, and actually I don't know how small the sizing goes. I wear a men's 7.5, and I'm at the small end of some of their sizing, but they are not necessarily expanding their street shoe line. Mm-hmm. They are expanding into their polo bike shoe line.
Interesting.
So I come from the old school style of polo in Portland when it first got started.
We're talking bike polo.
Yeah, bike polo, which used to happen just down the street from my old house. Yeah. And I kind of followed it, and I knew friends that helped get it started. And everyone just made their own mallets and put cardboard in their wheels to prevent people's mallets from jamming through their wheels. And you didn't buy products. And now there are products you can buy. And I've seen this elsewhere. You can buy mallets. You can buy stuff. And
yeah.
you can buy polo bikes, which is crazy because everyone just took the shittiest bike that they didn't want to damage. And maybe it was a little lower and had a little more stability. And that was their polo bike. So it's kind of a weird world. But at the same time, it's exciting to see that this like homegrown sport is, well, resurgence of it because it used to exist back, hundreds of
Way
years
back
ago
in
or
the
something,
day.
Whatever.
Yeah.
To see that it's catching on to the level that somebody once thinks there's an audience enough to make products for. It's disappointing to see that maybe that's more, that those niches are more the direction DZR might go in. They're also making shoes for downhillers, which are mountain bikers who pretty much don't climb up and earn their climb. They just like somehow get up there and then cruise down. Now, granted, they're talented. You got to be a real daredevil to do it. I know
say they're
woman,
descent specialists.
Yeah, descent specialists.
Right. Which means in street terms, they just don't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, so that was interesting, though. It was interesting to talk. It's great. I got to have these conversations with these folks and learn these details about their businesses and where they're headed, which is really interesting. I also spent some time talking with Alchemy Bags. They are out of Seattle, and they make bags out of recycled bike tubes.
Ooh.
They've been around for quite a while, mm-hmm. but their bags have really more been sold in specialty shops, college bookstores, apparel stores. Not they haven't really been sold in the bike industry, though they do go to some bike related events.
So it's more like a novelty?
It had been.
It has been.
Yeah, I feel like
a functional bicycling product.
Right. It was, day bags and shoulder bags, like
not messenger bags for bikers necessarily. Right.
Right. That wasn't as much of their focus, but they are energized by what's happening in the bike community, and they kind of want to go back to their roots and start developing products that are going to be relevant for bikers. Now, the benefits of using bike tubes, other than, of course, you're keeping millions of bike tubes go into the landfill every year, and it's
right.
great to be keeping those out of the landfill. But the company was started because the owner's messenger bag was stolen. And he's a super resourceful guy, and he didn't have any money, and he looked around his garage and saw all these bike tubes and was like, I can make a bike bag out
right,
of those,
right.
I guess. I don't have anything. I know how to sew. I don't have anything else.
Not using those for anything else.
Yeah. And if you've ever worked with bike tube, like, it's really hard to work with, and it buckles, and it's crazy. But he has worked on this for years, and he's really developed a great product. His rubber lays flat. It's really nice and malleable. It kind of has the feel and look of leather. It's extremely durable and is waterproof. So turns out bike tube's actually a great product for making wallets, belts. They make laptop holders, iPad holders. They make day bags and stuff like that. They make a really great messenger bag. And now they're starting to make some new things like a tool roll to put your tools in. And they're making some saddlebags, too, to fit on the back of your seat.
Pretty much everything you want.
Yeah. So now they've got a great line of new products. So they have gotten bike tubes from REI and Trek, both give all their used bike tubes and ship them to them. That is not even enough. They also go all around Seattle to collect bike tubes, and that's still not enough. So they're working on forming partnerships with some new large bike companies, and they don't have any negotiations locked in. But the exciting part is that everyone they've talked to so far has been very enthusiastic about what they're doing and wants to support what they're doing, which is great to hear from the big guys out there.
Yeah, that's great. And I mean, the idea that someone has a use for all of these tubes and they can actually find a way to use them, that's great. It reminds me of the most recent Radiolab episode was about all of the treated sewage from New York City's sewage system and how they tried to sell it and couldn't get rid of it and finally found farmers in Colorado that wanted to use it. It's fascinating. Go to radiolab.org, I think.
I think there's also a similar movement in like the rock climbing community with old ropes and like carabiners and recycling them and making them into usable products. So yeah, it seems like a good way to go. And those bags, the bags made out of bike tubes look really nice. Our friend has one.
Yeah.
Candace has one. And yeah, it looks for really sure. Gorgeous.
Yeah. It's kind of, it almost has this steampunk thing going for it. Like it kind of has like a,
if you added a few like cogs in there.
Right. Like a post-industrial or maybe like proto-industrial. I'm not sure what the correct terminology would be, but yes, it
bikes
looks
are steampunk,
cool.
So, right.
Yes.
It's like the same like cogs and like,
definitely
kind of machine.
Yeah, especially if you have like little pistons on your legs to help you with the, that's super steampunk.
Yeah, some grease.
Yeah, exactly.
Grease is totally steampunk.
And of course, goggles or a monocle.
Oh, goggles. Yeah. Oh, I love goggles.
Yeah. Well, anything else? We probably should wrap up here soon just because we've kept you long enough. But anything else from Interbike that you were super excited about or experiences that learned from?
Well, two things. I hung out with a couple fellas from Australia who have a product line called Two Wheel Cool, which is not yet available in the US, but you can check out their website. Silicone-based accessories, lights, and whatnot, but super fun Australians to hang out with. So that was great.
Australians are great.
Also, the big buzz about Interbike that you will hear if you follow big media sources related to cycling is they'll say, oh, there wasn't a lot of neat stuff from the big companies. They weren't really unveiling anything all that exciting. And to me, that was great because the focus then was able to be on the smaller guys, the Alchemies, the DZRs, the innovative new products got a lot of attention this year because the big guys didn't have anything all that great to showcase.
Right.
So that was great. And to me, that's the big takeaway from Interbike, that little guys are starting to get some attention now, and it's been a real uphill battle for a lot of them to find distributors and to get out into the product stream, but it looks like it's finally catching on.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. You can share the spotlight a little bit more.
Yeah, and you know, I've been doing a series of reviews of what I found most interesting. So on orbike.com, you can read a handful of Interbike reviews, and there'll be a bunch more rolling out over the next few weeks. We'll be unveiling about two every week.
Yeah. Nice. Well, excellent. We'll point people there.
Great.
What was the, where did they find that again?
On orbike.com.
All right. All right. You heard it. You heard it here first. Maybe not first, but you heard it here. Go do it. Did you win any money while you were in Vegas?
I didn't gamble.
Okay.
I like to play poker with my friends and gamble for low stakes, high fun, but I don't like gambling in Vegas.
That's the safest bet you could possibly make.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Well, cool. Thank you again for coming in.
My pleasure. It's been great.
While we're here with everybody, I've got one piece of news that's actually kind of interesting. The Wall Street Journal, and this was linked from Bike Portland's news roundup, I think last week. They have an article about office-friendly bike clothing. Don't sweat the commute, they say.
Oh.
And as the weather gets cooler, riding a bike to the office in work clothing is more feasible than it was in the sweltering summer heat. Velocipedists who'd rather not shower or change after hopping off their bikes have a closet full of cycling formal wear options. Clothing that looks office-friendly yet is comfortable to ride in, not too tight, vented to minimize sweating, and rain and wind resistant. Most important, the fabrics are stretchy enough to allow a full range of movement, but aren't so shiny that they look cheesy. So if you'd like to see kind of Wall Street Journal's rundown of what they think is good options, They mentioned a couple different things on there. We'll put the link up to that.
And they use the word velocipedus. Are you kidding me?
That's like some guy sitting down with a thesaurus to make the article more interesting.
He doesn't know if he should say cyclists or bikers, so he just says
bicyclist.
And people who ride bicycles is too wordy.
Exactly. So even though that might be the preferred terminology.
What's a velocipedist? Depending on who you talk to. We don't know.
Someone who walks really fast.
I won't say what.
Bullshit. We got just a little bit of mail. The Stick Man, who recently moved to Vegas, I believe, Twitters at us. Know anyone that tours on 26-inch rims, he asks. Friend in Vegas gifted me an old Trek mountain bike I may convert. Just curious how it worked versus my 700-centimeter I have on my commuter. And I Twittered back to him that 26-inch rims are actually the global standard for many people outside of North America. That's
hashtag
the easiest.
Yes. Global standard.
No kidding. Yeah. If you go abroad, you have far better chances of finding a 26-inch wheel, strangely, in all the metric countries than you do of finding a 700C wheel. And anyways, it's a good bet. So I would say if you're going to make a touring rig and you want to go far, do that.
This knowledge may save your life one day.
That's right. Yeah. And then Dan Flores, Aaron Flores' brother, says, addressing our question about which came first, rock and roll or rock and rye? Faygo, the soda company, their website says, Faygo Rock and Rye was created in the 1920s, long before anyone had to wake up Little Susie or tell Johnny to be good.
Wow.
Yep, rock and rye was king before the king was nothing but a hound dog. So, now we know.
Wait, really? They came up with the term rock and rye before there was rock and roll? That's
apparently
amazing.
What does that
so,
even refer to?
I'm even more curious.
Yeah, what did they mean by it? Because they didn't mean rock and roll.
It must have been a sexual metaphor.
Catcher
that's all
in the
I can
rye?
Think of.
No, that was.
Oh, it's fascinating.
Teenage angst.
Big Salinger fans. Yeah.
Well, good thing we don't have Google right now.
Seriously. Well, we're just going to have to live with the mystery. But we know more than we did. If anybody else comes across other things pertaining to rock and rye or anything else, you can send it to us at thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. So, hey, that's the end of everything. Alien, thank you again. Is there anything coming up that we should be aware of here in town or elsewhere?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head, though I will say just because we're coming into fall here in Portland, that doesn't mean that you hibernate in your house. There are a lot of people out there making an effort to make bike fun happen through the winter. So you will not need to ride alone. And if you don't know how to ride through the winter without totally being unhappy, cold, and wet, stay tuned to orbike.com because we are going to be running a series of articles on how to get through winter because you can do it. It's all about gear, but it doesn't have to mean you spend a ton of money.
That's awesome. When that goes live, you should come back and tell us about it.
Because my friend showed me a photo of what her pants looked like the other day, and she's like, what am I doing wrong? She's new to biking, and I'm kind of taking her on as my little pet project.
Did she have the skunk stripe up her back?
Unfortunately, it was actually from sweat.
Ooh.
And it was really gross.
Yeah.
So I won't name names because I told her I wouldn't tell anyone, but
sure.
The photo was disgusting. So she's going to be my little pet project this fall.
Yeah.
We're going to get her riding a lot more through the winter.
Yeah, I have problems every now and again with sweat. It's more in the summertime, but it's almost
with sweat.
It's like torso sweat that goes down to the pants after, because
we could do a whole show on this because no one talks about
No one talks about sweat.
Because you don't want to, but it's a reality of riding a bike.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, we're going to let's bookmark this and come back
sweaty.
To it.
Sweaty.
Yeah, definitely.
True confessions.
We got to come up with a good name for it. Getting sweaty.
Sounds good to me.
Sprocket Sweaty Podcast.
Sweat
Seriously.
It. Don't fret it.
We just call it nasty. Nasty show.
Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send feedback about the program, suggestions for topics, guests, or drinks via email. That address, again, is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Call us. Leave us a message. It's 503-847-9774. We won't pick up, so you don't have to be nervous while the phone is ringing. You can also text to it. Connect to us on Twitter at Sprocket Podcast. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for our theme music. He's at ryanjlane.bandcamp.com. We will see you all next week with another show. Till then, brush your teeth and floss. See you later. I think they do. I think they will.
Oh, it's the funny thing is, every time I've been on the show, you've been in a new location. This is my third time, third location.
I don't know how plants work. I'm a gardener by proxy. Just like I know how to wash dishes, but I don't know how to cook very well. And I know how to do laundry, but I can't fix my own clothes. There's a lot of things that I can do, like the menial. I'm a good grunt.
This interview is not officially started yet.
Seriously.
Because the bourbon hasn't been opened.
There we go. Adele actually knows where the scraps of paper are. I do not.
Oh, yeah. Do I need to read anything, bro?
Oh, do you want to?
Sure.
All right. Insert yourself where Aaron usually would.